Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar. Today, July 20th, 2026, we are delighted to host a conversation entitled Friendly Fire, CPRAE, Consent Decrees, and Trump v. IRS. My name is Emma Blakemore, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, I'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Anne Austin, Jeanette M. Brown, and Abby Combley as our panelists, with John Hsu as our moderator. Ms. Austin is senior advisor at Burke Law Group and founder of Austin Legal and Public Affairs. Ms. Brown is general counsel and senior litigation counsel for the New Civil Liberties Alliance. Mr. Combley is partner at Holtzman Vogel, and Mr. Hsu, in addition to appearing in the 1993 legal drama film Philadelphia, alongside Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington, is an attorney and legal commentator. And I'll leave it there. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any short questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that short questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. And so with that, thank you for being with us today. And I will turn things over to our moderator to start the conversation.
Thank you very much, Emma. Thanks to our panelists, Abby, Jeanette, and Anne, and thanks to all of you for joining us here at the Federalist Society for our webinar. Imagine this. Imagine that the NRA, the National Rifle Association, sues the United States government. And in response, the United States government says, we're not going to litigate. We're going to settle, and we're going to pay as damages $5 billion U.S. dollars to the NRA to be used for Second Amendment purposes. How would everybody feel about that? I think people here might feel a little differently than people at the People for the American Way. Today, we're going to discuss something similar that's been happening for ranching, grazing, animals, environmental issues, and even tax issues, especially down there in the Southern District of Florida. So for that, let's just start right off the bat. We're going to start with Jeanette. Jeanette, you are an expert in land use and grazing and animals. What has been going on with the Obama and Biden administration in the past, and what's been going on with our tax money that went out there?
So it's interesting. It actually started before the Obama administration, but it sort of reached at least what was at that point a peak during Obama, and that is sue and settle. That's where environmental groups, in this case, usually sue an administrative agency to try and obtain some action that they want that either the agency hasn't been able to provide or didn't provide initially. A lot of times this will happen after a change of administration. So an agency under one administration will take a position. They will then get sued during the next administration. And magically, the agency, who is run usually by compatriots or former compatriots of people in the environmental organization, reach an agreement, and they decide that they're going to do what each of them wanted to do all along, the staff in the agency and the environmental or public interest group, whatever the issue may be. And in the process, not only do they get what they want, but they get to slide some cash across the table from the government to the public interest. You see this in land use a lot when it comes to environmental issues like NEPA, in the requirement for undertaking studies, and then the environmental group might want further studies. You saw it in the oil and gas space where leases were promised and then they were sought to be enjoined, et cetera. And so that's the sort of background, most common use of sue and settlement. I've actually seen it used in other places where the government sort of gets on board with a public interest group taking a law further than it was meant to be. But the classic case is the government and a public interest group ultimately agree on what should be achieved. The public interest group sues the agency pays the public interest group, and in their view, everybody wins. In my view, in our view, the rule of law loses and the democratic process suffers.
Would you please explain what NEPA is for people who don't follow the environmental and other issues very carefully?
Well, it's the overarching environmental law that requires a lot of the environmental studies, National Environmental Protection Act, and it gets applied in forest plans, it gets applied in grazing, it gets applied anytime any action is going to take place with regard to a resource, a natural resource that the government controls. So whether it is the forests, the rivers, the oceans, all of those sort of things, there's a process that has to be followed with an environmental study and potentially an environmental impact statement, those sort of things. There are all sorts of factors that have to be considered during that process. There are lots of times stakeholders that have to be consulted during that process, and largely due to the APA and the environmental citizen suit provisions, those two things sort of work together to allow all of these sue and settle actions to occur, where a public interest group can come in and say, hey, look, one of our members is very interested in this particular section of forest. They visited every frequently, they intend to visit it again, and they're harmed by the fact that you're going to put, for example, cattle there or a gas well or whatever it might be. And so then they sue.
And let's move to you, because you have a lot of expertise in the environmental area. And thanks, Jeanette, for transitioning us over there. Tell us, Anne, about some of the unusual, let's just say unusual settlements that you've seen in the past where special interest groups will sue the EPA, and then magically there's an automatic settlement some very shortly down the line for often millions and millions of dollars. So, for example, the Sierra Club alone during the Obama and Biden years, they obtained more than $4 million in legal fees, just strictly legal fees. And then that doesn't include any of the settlement monies to the various organizations, including the Sierra Club. So would you please describe to us what the heck is going on over there?
Sure. So you'd see it break out in a variety of different contexts. As you know, Jeanette spoke to what she'd seen in her kind of space. It'll probably come as no surprise to anybody that has had dealings with the EPA. It is a statutorily driven agency. And what I mean by that is that there are a lot of deadlines associated with the different enabling statutes, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, RCRA, the whole kit and caboodle, CERCLA, that if the agency misses certain deadlines, at that point, it's not uncommon to see environmental or public interest groups sue the agency for having missed a statutory deadline. That usually drives a certain type of rulemaking or can kind of create an open policy question just by virtue of having missed that deadline. So when that happens, those groups can sue the agency, and it forces the agency to then take something that perhaps has, not to say fallen by the wayside, but again, for anybody that's done any work with EPA, they have a whole lot to do. And when those statutory deadlines were initially set, usually back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you know, it was the last time that the Clean Air Act was amended. With the passage of time and with resource constraints at the agency, it's not that easy to stick to those timelines and get things over the line, because the rulemaking process, et cetera, takes a certain amount of time. And there are only so many people and hours in the day to complete all of that work. So they will sue the agency for a missed deadline. Then that will force basically a reprioritization of something that they were going to get to eventually because they had to. But then it kind of gets pushed to the front of the line, and then the agency will take action on it through that settlement process. The challenge there is that that takes a larger process and deliberative time out of the equation in order to move forward with a very thoughtful you know, rulemaking, or if it's in the settlement context, it just, you know, kind of omits the APA opportunity in general for real, you know, public stakeholder engagement and transparency, which is, I think, fundamentally not what anybody on this call or listening in is remotely interested in. At the end of the day, if you want good government, it should be open, honest, and transparent to any and every public citizen that's interested. So it makes that incredibly difficult. The other way that I saw this utilized was in the supplemental environmental project context, which was if you had the EPA fined, either because there was a third party group that brought it to their attention, or through its own, you know, investigative authorities went after a somebody who is non-compliant, a company or an individual who's acting in an environmentally non-compliant way under the statute, under their permit, whatever the case may be. You go through an entire process, usually led by the Office of Environmental Compliance and Assurance, OECA. So at either the EPA level, you can get a supplemental environmental project in lieu of or as part of a settlement agreement, like a consent decree kind of organization. More likely than not, you're going to see this in a situation where you have a company that perhaps is not as big or as liquid and cannot foot the bill on a very significant penalty amount. So in lieu of that, they'll say, look, we can't pay that whole penalty amount. It would otherwise push us out of business. But how about this? We can do a supplemental environmental project. And either the EPA, or if it's above a certain amount, it gets kicked over to DOJ. It's referred over to DOJ is the proper terminology. Either the EPA or the DOJ can say, okay, well, based on our discussions with those interested parties in the more local communities, they would like to see A, B, C, ongoing monitoring in the area. Would you consider dedicating land and, you know, creating a park? Would you do, you know, any variety of things? And it really can run quite a gamut. And I would say that if for companies that are interested in kind of leveraging that type of alternative means of settlement, you would want to see that it's actually directly tied to the issue and to the, you know, most immediate area at play here that is experiencing, you know, environmental noncompliance. It's not unusual, though, to see that get busted up a bit more open, a little bit broader, and other parties being brought in, or projects speak to or be deployed and executed on that aren't really tied to either the area or the issue at hand as it relates to noncompliance. And I think that's where you get into a really dangerous position when it comes to what the government is thereby, you know, encouraging through these funding mechanisms, how things are being paid for, who's getting paid to do them. And it's a very slippery slope.
And so, Anne, are they, in your experience at EPA, are these settlement agreements, are they generally made public?
They are made public after the fact.
And when you were mentioning, for example, that the supplemental project, if that's part of the settlement, is not necessarily have to do with what's going on. So you, if you have a big multinational conglomerate that deals in different issues, let's say that they sue for something about air quality or radiation in the air or something, but for a supplemental project, they want to do something to save the whales in the Gulf of America. Is it, that's perfectly fine, that even though they don't really have anything to do with each other?
Depending upon who's negotiating it and what the priority interest is at that point in time. I mean, thankfully, when I was at the Trump administration the first time around, I did not see any of this because that was not allowed to happen. From my understanding is that, yes, that is within the realm of possibility.
And Jeanette, in your experience, the settlement agreements under the Obama and Biden administrations and past administrations, do they take into consideration economic matters? Like, for example, when they would sue for land use out in the Mountain West, do they take into consideration that, hey, we've got ranchers and farmers that depend on this stuff for a living? And why don't they?
They absolutely do not. And they don't even though. So, for instance, we would represent ranching or grazing organization and individual farmers or ranchers who had an interest in a grazing allotment or who had an interest in an oil and gas lease, developers, independent prospectors who had an interest in a lease. And we would intervene in the case. You have to, file a motion to intervene in this suit between the agency and the government and explain why your client has an interest and why the decision here can affect them. But once you do that, you have some very limited rights in terms of transfers, in terms of, fighting a motion to dismiss or whatever it might be. But particularly when there's a settlement, you really can do almost nothing. And the government, in my experience representing those parties, would not even keep you up to date on what the proposed terms were going back and forth. It was just presented to you as a package. And so in my experience, for example, the oil and gas holder, the leaseholder, can't drill in the meanwhile. Well, their lease is still running, right? And so they're running out of time to get this return on investment, to have this, to be able to execute on this right. Same thing, farmers and ranchers, you need to graze that that pasture or work it if you're going to hay it every season. Your cattle are depending on it. You have to feed them in the summer, you have to feed them in the winter. But if the government is saying, no, we're not going to allow that all of a sudden, that can throw your entire operation into disarray. But I never experienced a court considering that. And I never, frankly, considered the government asking. I never experienced the government asking about the impact that this would actually have on the farmers and ranchers.
Well, and according to what Jeanette is saying there, it sounds to me that in a lot of these cases in the past, not only is the government, like in the Biden administration, perfectly in tune with the Sierra Club or whatever, but a lot of former members of the Sierra Club work in the administration, or vice versa, members of the former administration work at the Sierra Club or whatever. Could you make an argument that that because they're so perfectly in line, that there's no case for controversy?
I think that you can. And I think that would be appropriate. I know that they're not necessarily adversarial, and certainly not in the sense that I think you would anticipate or contemplate kind of the purpose of a sue and settle opportunity existing within the federal administrative body of law. I think the challenge there is you don't want to remove the opportunity for settlement. That is a very appropriate and necessary legal tool. I unfortunately think that we've gotten to a point, is particularly in this space, that it's been weaponized. It's been weaponized very effectively by the other side. And look, I may be one person just taking kind of an unpopular position here, but shy of an equal, or perhaps in some cases, I would say in the absence of an equal response from the right side, when they have the opportunity to utilize this type of a tool, I don't see the left ever giving up on it. They've perfected it. They know exactly what they're doing with it. And I think that, when we are in a position to leverage that same tool and that same pathway that has been previously established to set smart policy, to set good policy, to use every single tool at our administrative disposal, I don't know that we are ever going to make the same level of administrative advancements that you see the left do every time they get 4 or 8 years in office. And I don't think that it is something that we should leave on the table. As much as on principle, I don't like saying that, at the same time, I firmly believe that you have to fight fire with fire at this point, because otherwise we stand to just continue to cede ground even when we hold it.
Well, that brings up a great point about the Administrative Procedures Act, the infamous APA. Abhi, you have APA experience both in your time in government and in the private sector. Abhi, are these settlements a way of making policy without going through all the strictures of the APA? And if so, is that appropriate?
So, yeah, I think there's a couple things that are at play. So there's obviously the APA type suits, which has kind of been the focus of the discussion so far. And then there's everything outside of the APA, which is kind of a separate category. And that's where you get things like police consent decrees and things of that sort. But yes, under, if you look at the strict APA statute, it does seem like settlements, you know, if you're suing under the APA and then getting a settlement without going through the APA rulemaking process, that can raise some issues. But at the same time, the Supreme Court has been presented multiple vehicles to address that issue and so far has declined to address it. So for the foreseeable future, I don't see any scenario, as Anne was saying, where the practice of settling lawsuits, even under the APA, is going to be going away.
And Abhi, with respect to the question of whether a case or controversy actually exists, there's an ongoing case in the Southern District of Florida where the Trump family and the President Trump as an individual, as a citizen, sued the IRS for leaking his and his family's tax returns. The DOJ settled. This is all well covered in the press. And Todd Blanche, our acting attorney general and AG nominee, and Stan Woodward, our associate attorney general, signed the settlement agreement. And the Judge Williams, she shot that down and she sanctioned everybody. And she said that this wasn't a case or controversy. Let's talk about the technical issues. Under FRCP's civil procedure, Rule 41, don't the plaintiffs have a right to voluntarily dismiss their case and settle the issue with the plaintiffs?
Yeah, so there's multiple things going on with that case. So I'm glad you raised that. So I think big picture, looking at the issue of whether adverseness is required under Article 3, there are some like older Supreme Court cases that discuss that in general terms. But I think the case, the Windsor case, where the Obama administration had a change of position regarding DOMA, and Justice Kennedy addressed the issue of whether there's still a case or controversy under Article 3. And basically, the way it was broken down is that there's two separate issues. There's Article 3 standing, whether you have an injury that's traceable to the defendant and that can be redressed by the court. If those factors are there, then there may be prudential considerations on whether there's enough adverseness for the court to make a decision. So big picture, the biggest protection against some of the problems that some of the earlier panelists raised with these types of settlements is the court doing its own due diligence and determining the legality of any such settlement. This case is much different, though, because all that happened was the plaintiffs, represented by counsel, filed a complaint. And DOJ never entered an appearance in the case. And then they voluntarily dismissed the case under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, Rule 41, which the judge acknowledged divests jurisdiction of the case. And that's important because the court was never asked to review a settlement here. Any settlement was done out of court. So at this point, the case is done, and the way it was reopened was a group of 35 amici federal judges filed a brief asking the judge to reopen the case, and she used Rule 11 sanctions as a workaround to Rule 41, which I'm skeptical provides jurisdiction if the case is dismissed and there was nothing for the judge to do at that point. So I think that there's a lot of incorrect information that's being talked about in this case. And a couple other things to note is that, one, the settlement agreement did not involve payments to the Trump family. It was the creation of the so-called weaponization fund, which the DOJ at this point has said won't happen anymore. So, and two, there was nothing for the court to even shoot down. So I think those are kind of some of the bigger issues at play beyond just the adverseness of the two parties.
So if the court, if the district court had been divested of jurisdiction because the DOJ dismissed the case and the plaintiffs also dismissed their case, then can the judge say, I'm going to sanction you anyway if there's no case?
So there's a couple things at play. So if it was for past conduct, there's at least theoretically a route for the judge to address that, but it can't be because amici who don't have a legal interest or standing in their own right say you should do it, that all of a sudden the court should do it. And in addition, DOJ never even entered appearance. So typically Rule 11 sanctions require notice and an opportunity to be heard. But the judge ordered letters to be sent to the state bars of Todd Blanche and Stanley Woodward without giving any real process for them to do that. And frankly, not even much of a process for the plaintiffs as well. So I think there's a lot of problems with how the judge went about this case. But again, it doesn't have the same problems as the Obama era sue and settle, because the court wasn't actually asked to do anything. The case was brought, then the case was dismissed, and that should have been the end of the story.
I should add for clarification that the 35 people who signed the amici letter, Abhi mentioned they're federal judges. I should clarify that they're retired or former federal judges, not in active service. That would be really bad if they were still in active service, but they're not. Well, Jeanette, you heard Anne saying before, hey, you know, I theoretically don't like the idea of sue and settle, but until we do it to them, they're going to keep doing it to us. So like if we convince the administration, if the NRA sues the administration and they get a lot of money out of it, kind of like the Sierra Club does and other groups, what do you think about Anne's position?
Yeah, I tend to disagree with that for a couple of reasons. One, when you look at sue and settle specifically, it's ironic, I think, that at the very beginning, the greatest concern was not the revolving door between agencies and public interest firms. It was the alleged revolving door between agencies and big business. And so it was actually the left that was afraid of sue and settle because they thought it would be the close relationship between agency and big business. That flipped. And I think that sort of shows you that once you've unloosed a tool, you don't really control how it gets used or who it gets used by. But I also think, to my sort of opening point, sue and settle has a lot of problems in terms of the rule of law and transparency. And I think that if both sides basically say, look, we're going to set aside what we consider to be good government and the rule of law and sort of the ideals of the founders and just move forward to fight fire with fire, you should expect the wind to change and you're going to get burned by your own fire. It's just, I think it's a bad idea to consciously pursue something that you consider to be good government just because the other side is weaponizing that particular method.
Is it a reasonable counterargument to say, well, Jeanette, that's all well and good, but if we don't fight fire with fire, and we are perfect gentlemen and gentle ladies legally, that the left will do it anyway?
I understand the practicality. If I'm nothing but practical, but I think that you have to find a different way to go about it. You have to find a way more consistent with the rule of law. And these things, I think, to Anne's point, settlements are sometimes necessary. They are sometimes efficient. They are sometimes, oftentimes, the right case to do. The majority of civil cases settle. And so you can't rule that out, but you do need to put some guardrails around this. And I think that there's various ways to do that. And, you know, if Anne is correct, maybe this will be the time when we realize either we need to not do it or we need to do it better.
Anne, I'm going to challenge you a little bit here. Let's say Jeanette's right, and we could put around guardrails or protective procedures in place. So, for example, you were talking about the supplemental projects. Mm-hmm. You know, could we make the supplemental projects, could we require that they be actually related to the litigation or the issue that's being litigated? So how would you create and push through these guardrails that Jeanette is talking about? What kind of guardrails would you like to see?
So the one I would like to see the most is one set by Congress that is not going to get whipsawed back and forth from one administration to the next. I think the challenge we see right now is a largely paralyzed Congress, and not because things don't get done there. Some things do, but honestly, you know, we're dealing with slim slim margins here, and anything in the environmental arena becomes, I mean, a battle royale, and it is very hard to get anything done. So candidly, I don't know that in this space at this point in time, you're going to see any movement on that front where Congress would be willing in a bipartisan manner to step up and say, look, this really isn't working the way that we want it to. Let's put some guardrails on it. Like, if you are going to settle on something that is, you know, related to a particular permit or an act of noncompliance, and that, you know, supplemental environment, that SEP has to be tailored to the location, to the community. It cannot exceed, you know, we're not going to pay attorney's fees in excess of X number of dollars, whatever the case may be. I think that would be great. I think that would be a tremendous step in the right direction. I just don't have a lot of faith that that's going to happen right now. Until that does happen, I think that there is a very strong argument to be made, again, although in theory and in principle, not where I normally land, is that you need to fight fire with fire. And that might actually wind up being the catalyzing moment that draws those members together and say, whoa, 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 okay, we may need to revisit this. But so far, it is a tool that's been dominated by the left very effectively. And it continues to move the policy needle in a variety of different ways. Like, I'll give you a prime example. Even in the compliance space, where in theory you should think that these individual settlements should not be precedent setting, it's not how they're treated. It's not how they're treated. When you talk to the DOJ line attorneys, they say, well, we've handled it this way in other cases, so we're going to take a very similar position and we're really not comfortable moving off of it. Oh, okay. So you are setting policy and it's happening at that level. Okay, well, that's really good to know. Was that the intention of, you know, granting authority to an agency at that level like DOJ, the ability to move policy over there versus EPA, for example? You might have a different administration say, you know what, that's not how we're going to do it. That's not how we're going to prioritize things. Once things get referred over to DOJ, a lot of it's out of the EPA hands. I saw a lot of that happen at the tail end of the last administration. Compliance issues that they saw were going to probably be more openly and fairly negotiated under the second Trump administration got kicked over at the 11th hour to the DOJ. And that's what you have to deal with now. And look, if that's going to be the case, I think we should be fighting fire with fire. I see, you know, a greater level of policy movement that should be pushed by the conservative side in an effort to try to, you know, keep the pendulum more in the middle as opposed to these wild swings. But right now, every time you have a change in administration that moves to the left, everything keeps moving to the left, even incrementally, even through big national rulemakings, and we're just leaving a whole lot on the table.
Abhi, two questions for you with respect to what Anne was describing. First question, when she's talking about the weight of precedential value of some of these settlements, is the volume, the number of these settlements on similar issues, does that have any weight at DOJ when considering what to do? And number two, for the DOJ, and would they want to see some of this stuff like the guardrails that Anne and Jeanette were mentioned? Would they want to see it also through legislation, or would they want to do Code of Federal Regulation stuff and push through the regulations that way?
So yeah, I can't speak for big picture DOJ, but I can say that there is definitely a lot of weight given to past practice within DOJ. So typically, if you've done something before, you're going to typically be on solid ground when you do it again. So for instance, if there are consent decrees utilized or settlement agreements that by past administrations, and there is certainly a past practice developed to do that. One of the things that DOJ has done, especially in some of their settlements that involve, you know, past administration rules, is that they've set a time limit on any consent decree so that it expires after a certain amount of time, which could be one safeguard. But I do think that there is middle ground between kind of this Obama era sue and settle and getting positive settlements, especially when you're involved in litigation involving the past administration. I think when you have the government as a party, the democratic process elected the president, Trump, for instance, to not just continue defending Biden-era rules. That would be a little bit off if they elected Trump to go in a different, in one direction, but still at the same time requires them to defend the Biden-era litigation. So I do think that there are some avenues to allow for settlements. And I think the big reason that courts didn't address the Obama and Biden era sue and settle is that it's hard to know where exactly to draw the line between what is a so-called sue and settle and what is a normal settlement that should be allowed. So I do think that there is a middle ground there. And I think the big picture key is a judge doing an independent review on whether the settlement is within the bounds of the litigating issue and whether the underlying party is ultimately right on the law. And I think because a court does have the ability to reject a settlement if it comes to it on a wide variety of grounds. And I think that as long as judges are doing their due diligence, then that could become less of an issue. But oftentimes, one of the issues in the Obama era is that judges were not doing that.
Well, Abhi, but you were saying the judge has the power to accept or reject this settlement. Doesn't that require the DOJ to actually make an appearance first and actually, you know, actually respond to a complaint?
Yes, and it requires DOJ or a settlement to actually be proposed as well. So there are definitely some a number of layers that need to happen before that even is addressed.
And in the Florida case, Abhi, it seemed to me that the judge, when describing the power and influence that the president himself has over the Treasury Department and the Justice Department, it seemed to me that she was approving of and sanctioning the unitary executive, which was a mild surprise to me. Do you think she was saying that the unitary executive is a thing? Have they come to accept the unitary executive?
So I'm not sure kind of where exactly Judge Williams lands on the unitary executive theory. One of the things that sets this one apart was that President Trump was suing in his personal capacity for something that everyone agrees did happen to him. The IRS did leak his data. And as someone who was a victim of that, there should be some avenue for redress. But one of the things that stands out about this case is that there was ultimately no payment made to President Trump, even with the out-of-court settlement. With some of these sue and settles, what you see is that there's payments and oftentimes millions in attorney's fees that goes to the other side. That didn't happen here. And instead, there was, as I mentioned earlier, a weaponization fund that never ended up happening to begin with. So I do think that this case presents some differences. And I do think that Article 3 is satisfied because there was an injury that President Trump suffered. It was traceable to the IRS and it could be redressed by the court. But because he's also president, it presents some questions that courts really haven't had to deal with before. But I do think that the traditional Article 3 factors have been met. And then it's the issue of the prudential issue of adverseness. That was what Judge Williams was hanging on to in that one.
So, Abhi, if you're saying that there's a difference between Trump, the individual human, and Trump, the president of the United States and the head of Article 2, isn't Judge Williams within her rights to say, well, if Trump the human thinks that he was injured and deserves some kind of settlement from the IRS, whether it's monetary or not, what is he supposed to do? He's supposed to have an inner dialogue with Trump the president and then ask the DOJ and the Treasury Department to settle? Or how does that work?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple things, because I think the big picture that we have to keep in mind in that case is whether it was sanctionable to even bring the lawsuit, which I think is where her reasoning goes way off the rails. But I think the other kind of big picture issue is that doesn't get talked about enough in this conversation is that the federal government has a wide variety of out-of-court ways to address an issue, and that's ultimately the route that the plaintiffs chose in this case. So ultimately, it didn't even require court intervention to have a settlement at the end of this. But the judge kind of reopened it to put it back in her court so that she could do a Rule 11 sanction for something she didn't believe she had jurisdiction to deal with to begin with. So I do think that the problem is a lot less given that in terms of the out in court problem. And at the same time, if there was ever a settlement presented to her, the judge would be within her bounds to reject it if he didn't feel that there was sufficient adverseness for her to make a reasoned decision on what the law is.
Anne, in your experience in both the private sector and in government, have you ever been involved in or do you know of cases where the plaintiffs will file a complaint thinking or maybe even hoping that, hey, we're going to settle at some point. So this is what we should think about that we can live with for the settlement. Because according to Judge Williams, if you file a complaint with the intent to settle, you've committed a Rule 11 sanctionable act.
So, yes, absolutely. And I think that if settlement has crossed your mind at some point along the way, either because, you know, you've raised it yourself or perhaps your counsel has raised it to you as, hey, this is something you need to consider. By no means should that be a sanctionable offense. But yeah, no, I have seen that in both of those capacities during my time in the public and private sectors. And I don't think, again, that there's fundamentally anything wrong with that. Where I do have an issue, and I think Jeanette would agree with this, it's where you get into a situation where it looks like there's pretty deliberate circumvention of the APA. That's the issue there. If you want to change policy at that level, then it needs to go through the APA. You need to go through a formal process or even an informal APA process, but it needs to be one that is transparent. Public stakeholders are encouraged and alerted. They're put on notice that they have an opportunity to weigh in and to follow the process. And that's where I think the sue and settle situation has gotten out of hand.
But Anne, you would agree, would you not, that normally in a settlement, outside parties, the general public doesn't usually get a chance to weigh in for a comment on the settlement between like an agency and an entity?
Sure, 100%, but you're usually dealing with private interests that are discrete to the parties. You're not dealing with, you know, significant matters that have nationwide implications.
Well, Jeanette, Anne said that she's sure that you agree. So do you actually agree with what she said?
I hope you agree, Jeanette.
I do actually agree. And I think this circles back to one of the questions that you asked me at the outset, which is, does the court take other impacts into effect? If you did have to go through some sort of APA or mini APA process, the agency would have to show that they actually considered those impacts and how they weighed things against one another. And I think, you know, theoretically, that could be part of a remedy, at least in the APA context, is the agency has to show its work like they would in other sort of policy making decisions. And, you know, we talk about the Southern District of Florida opinion, but there was also an opinion from EDVA, the Eastern District of Virginia, enjoining on a preliminary basis the weaponization fund or the transfer of any money. And interestingly enough, part of the basis of that suit was the APA. And I think that raises a question as to whether now people will try to attack these sue and settle settlements through an APA process. Again, it appears that is what's being done on the left. And so it'll be interesting to see whether that becomes a new tool that gets employed and whether, if so, it gets employed equally across the sides.
And Jeanette, is this something that can be done, you know, through the CFR, or do we need actual legislation to do this?
I don't. I'm not a fan of the administrative state. I'm not a fan of the CFR. I think the CFR subjects you to that sort of pendulum process. And so I very much think that this should be a congressional statutory solution.
Well, let me push you just a little extra here. Congress can't even decide what to put on the Capitol Hill menu. They can't even pass a budget. How are they going to address some of these issues like that you just mentioned? And like Anne was saying, that some of these supplemental projects should actually relate to deal with the same issue as the litigation. You'd think it's a couple sentences as an amendment to the statute. It shouldn't be that hard. But how are they going to do that if they can't even pass a budget?
Well, I agree with Anne that there has to be something that occurs that makes it a priority for them. So whether that it comes through a fight fire by fire and the pendulum continues to swing until it reaches a point where it's unacceptable to anyone, or perhaps, you know, here with what happened in Southern District of Florida, the Congress may legitimately get concerned about the role and the legitimacy of courts and the, you know, view that the public has of courts in this role and whether they're actually sort of fairly calling balls and strikes or whether they're reaching out to do things that they shouldn't or ignoring things that they should. I think one way or another, there has to be some sort of an apex of a crisis that brings this so that Congress will actually do something.
And I'd like to bring up a Fifth Circuit case, especially because when you were at the EPA, one of your areas was Texas and Louisiana that you were overseeing. And you actually were the land commissioner in Texas for some time.
Deputy land commissioner.
Yeah, deputy land commissioner. Mm-hmm. And so I want to bring up this case of Louisiana versus Holland. It's the situation where it involves the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which I wasn't familiar with that agency until this lawsuit. And mm-hmm. basically the issue was we have to protect the 50 odd rice whales. Rice whales are ginormous whales, and a subsidiary of the Bruder's whale. But there's some settlement there where the Biden administration settled and basically put all kinds of restrictions on the American energy industry for the Gulf of America. And can you tell us a little bit about that? Why did the Fifth Circuit take it, and what's going to happen with that case?
Sure. So I am not terribly familiar with that case, just to be very honest with you. What I can tell you, just based on what you shared with me, is that that is one of those things where I am it sounds like the Fifth Circuit saw what was happening and said, that's a big overstep, and thankfully made it through and up to the Fifth Circuit to address this issue. That is a very typical tactic under the Endangered Species Act for a environmental interest organization to sue the Department of the Interior or to sue a state for failing to consider the Endangered Species Act, the best available science. And it sounds like the argument was made that this particular type of bird, this quail, was endangered, or you didn't have enough information to suggest that it was not endangered. So the oil and gas industry within Louisiana would otherwise just need to come to a screeching halt in an effort not to otherwise damage, harm, or have any evidence of taking of that animal. It sounds like, and I'm hopeful that what the Fifth said was that, that's not how you play that game. That's a Department of Interior decision to make. They are the federal agency with the authority to determine whether or not, you know, a species needs to be listed or delisted under the Endangered Species Act. And that's the way that's supposed to go. Now, I'm speaking out of turn. Like I said, I've not read that case, but that sounds like a pretty typical, you know, kind of method or posture taken by ENGOs and in an effort to stifle industry activity.
Jeanette, one of the arguments used to challenge the settlement was that basically the Biden administration was trying to shove through policies for companies operating in the Gulf of America that they wouldn't have been able to shove through under the APA strictly. Is there any weight to that argument, or is that just a desperation plea from the industry?
Well, yeah, my understanding, and I have only the very highest level of understanding of the case, and so I thought that the allegation was not only as you explained it, but that the agency actually went further than they would be allowed to go under the statute, so that they were making a settlement that would be contrary to statute. And so that's exactly the sort of case where, you know, there should be sort of an anti-APA to an APA settlement. I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with the case to say whether or not that specific allegation in that case is grounded. But it wouldn't, based on my sort of experience with the land agency cases, it wouldn't surprise me because, again, the government there is sort of taking actions on a shortcut basis that they wouldn't be allowed to take if they were going through not only the proper administrative channels, but a lot of time proper environmental analysis in terms of impact. And so I think that a lot of times the sue and settle is a mechanism to get around transparency, process, and other legal, substantive legal restraints.
Jeanette, why is it okay to restrict the oil and gas industry in the Gulf of America from allegedly harming the rice whales, but it's perfectly fine to let the water windmill companies build these ginormous windmills off the coast of New Jersey that actually have killed whales? Why is that perfectly fine with the Biden administration?
Well, I can't answer that question because it doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, if one were applying the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, even-handedly, a take is a take, and that shouldn't be allowed. Now, agencies can approve what's called an incidental take and figure out the level for all of that. But the bottom line is what you're talking about in terms of the sauce that's good for the goose is no longer good for the gander. And that's the whole problem with this sue and settle approach and generally with the swinging pendulum. The law changes depending on who it's being enforced against.
All right. In the last 10 minutes we have here, let's do some question and answers. Thank you for all those who have submitted their questions. You're more than welcome to keep submitting questions because I can multitask. So first question to Ann as a hard-nosed litigator. For Judge Williams's order issuing sanctions against the plaintiff's attorneys, the attorneys who represent the president himself and the Trump family, and also sanctioning Todd Blanche and Stan Woodward, are those sanctions appealable? What do they do? And do they do it individually or all at once?
I would say that, at this point, I think they should be appealed. I think that that issue should be fundamentally addressed. And that type of attempt at use at sanctions, as Abhi laid out, is just, it's pretty outrageous. So if that's going to be the case, I would say take it up individually.
Jeanette, we have a question specifically for you. When you said before that the sue and settle practice had existed before the Obama administration, in your experience, how long has it gone back?
Well, I've seen stats tracking it back to at least the second Clinton administration. But when I was talking about the original fear of sue and settle, that dated back to the creation of the citizen suit provisions back in the 70s. So the fear was there, and this has evolved or devolved, if you will, over time.
And John, can I just add something there that I think is very unique and that folks ought to think about when it comes to kind of the argument about the pendulum swing? You know, Jeanette's right that is where that fear was originally born out of, was that you were going to see the private sector suing the government a lot. And that is not how that's actually played out. And I think one thing to be mindful of here is that one reason why you see ENGOs and public interest groups get so excited about the sue and settle opportunity as a legal tool is that at the end of the day, they are not regulated entities. So the fear about the private sector, industry, companies, et cetera, you know, using that as a tool in order to, you know, push government regulatory decisions in their directions has not played out, because at the end of the day, as the pendulum swings and as it swings more widely from one administration to the next, I think it's fair to say that you have industry that has not been particularly interested in leveraging that tool because of the fear of repercussions when the pendulum swings back the other way. Your ENGOs and public interest groups, no fear on that front whatsoever. They don't have that kind of skin in the game.
Yeah, Jeanette, you had mentioned before, you know, about sometimes there's a revolving door between the government and going to work for ExxonMobil or something like that, and vice versa. But Why is it because of that fear of regulation that Ann mentioned? Why doesn't ExxonMobil sue and settle more?
I do think it's not only the fear of regulation, but more, you know, if you're a public company and you've got your reputation to be concerned about, you don't want to be demonized now as a public company for being anti-environmental. And so you have to very carefully manage your image in order to move forward with your business and please your stockholders. So I think that there are sort of extra legal concerns that affect corporations and people in business trying to earn profit the way that they don't affect the NGOs of any sort.
What about NGOs on the right? How come they don't sue and settle more often? We've had some Republican administrations in there.
I think for one thing, in the environmental space where I'm accustomed, there aren't that many of them that have an opposite view. There are any endless number of pro-environmental, you know, going well beyond conservation. So, you know, I'm a fan of conservation. I think, you know, it's important to have a balance, and there aren't really NGOs that are pushing for a balance. There aren't NGOs that are really sort of in the center, and you don't see far anti-environmental organizations. They're just not out there.
And Jeanette, because you have worked a lot with the states in the past, is there a sue and settle dynamic? If, let's say, the DOJ sues a state or a state sues the DOJ, is there a sue and settle dynamic there as well?
I am a little bit less familiar, but I do think so. And it came up recently. I think there was a case between the United States and Texas, for instance. And my understanding is the complaint and the settlement were filed on the same day. Now, on the one hand, that gives the impression of sue and settle, but also historically, a long time ago, I used to practice in bankruptcy, and you'd go to bankruptcy a lot of times with what's called a prepackaged bankruptcy plan, right? And it certainly there's adversity, there's competing interest. But in the interest of all stakeholders, you also need to keep moving forward. And so you have a plan from the outset. To Anne's point, that doesn't necessarily mean that that plan is any way lacking in morals or adversity.
But that kind of prepackaged bankruptcy is something that all the stakeholders have something. I mean, they all get involved in creating that package, do they not?
Usually, although, you know, it's not uncommon to say, you know, the creditors committee or somebody is going to disagree, because you very seldom will get unanimous consent. So, but that is an important distinction, and it goes back to the need for maybe we need some sort of a mini APA process for an APA settlement.
Abhi, we got some questions for you, and we've got a little bit over 2.5 minutes left. The first question for you is if you think Judge Williams erred in her in reopening the case under Rule 11, and if she should have done that under Rule 41, as we discussed earlier.
Yeah. So going back to the questions about what options are there, plaintiff's counsel does have the option to appeal. Whether that's done through, this is kind of weird to have a dismissed case do it in this posture, but it can be an interlocutory appeal theoretically, or it could just be mandamus is another tool that that the plaintiffs have. But yeah, it definitely, when you include it, it is kind of an irony that one of the biggest qualms that Judge Williams had was the lack of Article III case or controversy, but she reopened the case for 35 former federal judges who have no legal interest in the case and would not have standing on their own to intervene. So that is an interesting dynamic. And I do think that it is a big stretch that if it were to be appealed, I think that the plaintiff's counsel or DOJ or whoever appeals it would have a pretty good shot.
I think plaintiffs could also appeal the injunction. I think there's a question whether or not the injunction meets the requirements of specificity. So that might be another avenue.
You mean it's too broad, Jeanette?
Yeah, it's too broad. It's not sufficiently specific. It doesn't do what a lot of people publicly are claiming it does in terms of actually voiding the contract, the settlement agreement, which is a contract. And I just think that when you read the language, the one paragraph devoted to that injunction, I have a question of whether or not it would satisfy a court of appeals.
For all three of you, have any of you ever heard of a district court judge sanctioning the acting Attorney General of the United States and the confirmed Associate Attorney General of the United States for settling a case. Abhi, we'll start with you.
So I think I'd have to look back. I'm not aware of any offhand, but I think the what's kind of more egregious about this is that they never nobody entered appearance for DOJ. So it would it's just really odd to issue sanctions when no, and I want to be a little precise. She didn't quite issue a sanction. What she did was she had the clerk of the court mail a copy of the order to the state bars of these two. So it's not directly a sanction, but it does, it effectively acts like one. But I've never heard of it happen in this scenario. But I could imagine a scenario where DOJ or someone else was a defendant in an action and there was some contempt proceeding. I'm sure some instances out there somewhere of them being held in contempt, but never under these set of facts for sure.
Yeah, but she's referring it to this to the respective state bars for some kind of discipline, some kind of punishment, even if it wasn't a sanction. I mean, that's...
Yeah, that's especially problematic given that they were never attorneys on record in the case.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to do this to Jeanette and Anne. You'll have to forgive me. I'll take you out for ice cream the next time I'm in the DC area to make up for it. But we are out of time. So thanks to our panelists, to Abhi, to Jeanette, to Anne for the wonderful job that they just did. And it was very educational, certainly to me. And thanks for all the folks on the webinar who participated and who listened. And I hope you also found it educational and edifying. Emma? Back to you.
Thank you so much. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time. Thank you for your expertise today. I also just want to thank our audience for joining and participating as well. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, please keep an eye on our website and on your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. So thank you all for joining us today, and we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.